are listening to Conversations with Nathan Latka, where I sit down and interview the top SaaS founders, like Eric Yuan from Zoom. If you'd like to subscribe, go to getlatka.com. We've published thousands of these interviews, and if you want to sort through them quickly by revenue or churn, CAC, valuation, or other metrics, the easiest way to do that is to go to getlatka.com and use our filtering tool. It's like a big Excel sheet for all of these podcast interviews. Check it out right now at getlatka.com.
And then it was a real slog to get to a million. You're growing 50%, 70% year over year, and you're profitable. Like, you idiot, why don't you raise money? So my co-founder and I are still the majority owner, is still in control of the company. Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I'm going to tell you about how we scaled our way up to over 50 million in ARR, which was about our size when we did our $180 million round in 2022. But first, I'm going to tell you about how we got started and the bootstrapping journey, which I know many of you are doing here in the room. All right, so here is the overnight success story. Started in 2005, launched Muckrack in 2009, and then we did that round in 2022. I'll come back to that slide in a moment. I actually got my start podcasting, similar to Andrew and Nathan, where I was interviewing founders, but I actually started all the way back in 2005. So a lot of people don't know this. Podcasting is called podcasting because originally you could only listen on your iPod. This Photoshop here is kind of wrong because the iPods weren't in color back then. But got this early start in podcasting. I interviewed Reid Hoffman back when LinkedIn had 50 employees, the founder of Yelp, Vanguard Group, Brooklyn Brewery. If only I had money back then, I could have angel invested in those companies. I would have made really a lot on that, but I didn't. But I met all these great people. One of the people I interviewed back in 2005 was Evan Williams, who had this really hot startup called Odeo, which itself was a podcasting company. If you've never heard of it, it's because it didn't work, but Ev's a smart guy. He pivoted. Can anyone guess what he pivoted to? Twitter, that's right. So this is the original Twitter logo back before they could afford the vowels. And ironically, they've lost all the vowels again now that Elon's renamed it X. But this was 2006, 2007 when Twitter was just getting going. It led me to sign up really early. I got my first name on there because no one else grabbed it. So I got at Gregory on Twitter and later on Instagram too. This is the First Name Club logo, which I made with Dolly last night. So I was getting to see all this social media really early on. And one of the pain points that my co-founder, Lee Semmel, and I noticed in those early days was that there was no way to know, hey, if you're interested in news or sports or politics, like, who should you follow on social media? This was back in 2008. So we thought we'd launch an award website called the Shorty Awards, because tweets are short, and let people vote with a tweet. So we built the first ever system. Now that's commonplace. You know, you want to vote, share it on social media. No one had done that before. So when we launched it, within 24 hours, it became the top trending term on Twitter. And then we had to drop everything, organize the first Shorty Awards. It's still a thriving business. We got, over the years, DJ Khaled, Carly Kloss, Lizzo, lots of other amazing celebrities and social media influencers there, as well as brands and agencies. But what we noticed at the Shorty Awards is that that we got a tremendous amount of press. And I'm sure you all know when you launch something, it's really hard to get attention for it. I'd launched things before in my podcasting days, really hard to get press. With the Shorty Awards, we instantly got written up in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, BBC. So we realized, like, hey, journalists are on social media trying to figure out what to write about, but there's no one place to figure out where you can find all those journalists. So we thought, okay, let's build a site to do that, just to show all the journalists one place. We weren't thinking about SaaS or anything like that at the time. And to come up with a name, we have to go back now all the way to 1906. This is Teddy Roosevelt, where he dubbed these progressive investigative journalists muckrakers, because they're digging through the muck, the mud, to find stories. Over, it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, almost a little derogatory at first, but over the years, journalists really adopted that and viewed it as a positive. They viewed, you know, if you're a muckraker, you're really investigating and going beyond the press release. So we knew journalists liked that idea of muckrakers. We figured all the journalists are going to be in one place, so it's going to be like a newspaper rack or a magazine rack. And we embraced our bootstrapping constraint. We had an $8 branding budget, which is what it cost to buy a domain name on GoDaddy at the time. And it turned out muckrack.com was free. So we built the first version of Muckrack in 2 weeks. It was kind of wafer thin, but it was a way for journalists to show all their social profiles, show off their work. It took off virally with journalists, so we had over 10,000 journalists request to get added in that first year. At the time, I got to admit, we were kind of unfocused. We were doing the Shorty Awards again. We launched like five other business ideas that didn't end up working. But Muckrack, we just let it run, and it kept getting more and more journalists. And being in New York at the time, I kept running into PR people. When I told them what I did, they say, oh, I use Muckrack to figure out which journalists to pitch. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. We have this whole audience of people using our website to do their job. We have the data. We even have a little brand amongst these people. And like idiots, we're not charging for it. Also from running the Shorty Awards, as I'm sure Nathan or anyone who runs an event could attest, it was always profitable, but we always had to start from zero. And I'd seen friends of mine launch SaaS businesses like Hootsuite and MailChimp before us, and I saw how powerful that was to have predictable revenue. So we relaunched Muckrack a year, this is what it looks like now, but we relaunched Muckrack a year later and in 2011 and added in the SaaS part. The rest is history, as I'll talk about in a moment. So let me tell you about the bootstrapping journey now. Here's that timeline I showed again. So again, it was 2009 here that we launched Muckrack, 2011 that we pivoted to SaaS. And then it was a real slog to get to a million. It was pretty much 3-4 years of just hacking away at it. And we'd raised pretty much next to no money. It was under 200K of angel was the only primary capital we ever took. And we used some of the profits from the Shorties, which was still part of the same company at the time that we reinvested in Muckrack. And so every day it was just talking to customers, figuring out what would happen to get to a million. And it was really clarifying because we had to like find customer pain points that we could solve quickly and with the tech resources that we had. And because, on one hand, we couldn't invest money like we could had we raised a bunch. But on the other hand, we weren't answering to investors. We weren't thinking about how to position for the next round. It was, how do we get the next customer? I was personally doing the customer support for longer than I care to admit, and it was really just kind of do or die to get to that million. And once we did that, though, we kind of knew we had something, and we kept scaling. And here's our ramp where it shows our revenue, our ARR, or pretty much our ARR, compared to our annualized expenses. And in this graph launched the secret in that since 2022, before 2022, everyone was like, hey, you're growing, you're growing 50%, 70% year over year, and you're profitable, like, you idiot, why don't you raise money and grow 300% year over year? Since 2022, no one ever says that anymore. Everyone's like, well, what's the secret to being profitable? How do you profitably grow? And this is the answer, it's the secret. Spend less than you make. That's what we always did. We always tried to reinvest as much as we could because we knew we were growing, we believed in the future, we knew that there was always more to invest in the company, but we just constrained ourselves by the ARR and also leaving a comfortable cash cushion in the bank. I always aim for 2 or 3 months worth of whatever our total expenses were to have in the bank. Didn't always follow that, but that was always the goal early on, and it worked. So I think it's, I'm not religious about it. I know some people do very well going out there, raising a bunch of money to grow. And I think a lot of people have the misconception. I know a lot of people here might be at like the 5 $10 million ARR mark, and maybe you're thinking like, oh, you know, if I want to really go big, like I have to either decide I want to be this tiny little lifestyle business forever, or I got to go raise money if I want to go big. I don't think it's that dichotomy. Maybe it is the right move to raise money, but I think there is a path where you can keep reinvesting. And what I really learned was like at these different stages, like getting to a million, I guess you have to index it for inflation too, maybe now it's 2 million, but it feels really good. But it's still till like 5 million, 7 million, 8 million for us. I found it was always this really kind of painful trade-off where every time we'd get a couple hundred K more in revenue and we could invest, you know, reinvest it, it was always this impossible conversation. It's like, do we hire the salesperson? Do we hire the programmer? Do we increase the servers? Do we finally get a better coffee maker for the office back when we had one? So it was really tough, you know, that kind of 5 to 10. But then I found once we approached 10, it flipped where all of a sudden we had plenty of money. And the harder part became finding the right people to hire, figuring out what position to bring in next, really educating ourselves. Because it's just facing all these decisions like, hey, we got to hire a CFO. What does the CFO do? You know, if you've never hired one before, and educating yourself about that, or figuring out, okay, we need to add a layer of management in the sales team. How do we go about that? Do we bring people in outside, bring in new people? So that the challenges change, but I think you can just get to that 10 million. It is a rough mark. That's when it starts to flip and you start feeling the pinch for cash, at least in a lot of SaaS businesses. I also want to show, this is just a Google Trends results for Muckrack. You could look it up yourself. And from our founding of 2009 till today. And I think it really shows the power of building a brand. One thing we always thought about was that you have to do lots of things to get known in your industry. One's PR, that's a little self-serving because that's what our software does, but PR, events, going out there, meeting customers, creating content, all these things you have to do to get known in your industry. We did a lot of long-term bets. We even launched this free academy to teach people how to do PR very early in their careers. It's a free certification, anyone can take it, academy.muckrack.com. And we know like we're not going to see ROI on that for 3 or 4 years because it's someone super junior with no buying power taking it. But our bet is, hey, in 4 or 5 years after they take it, maybe they're a director somewhere and they'll recommend it to their boss. In 10 years, they'll be the VP and they'll be making that buying decision. So we just always invested into the brand. And I think this is hard because a lot of us, when we're bootstrapping, we feel like we have to be so analytical. And you hear these stories where someone says, hey, we know with our Google ad spend or our social ad spend, we invest a dollar, we get a dollar 20 out. With a lot of these long-term brand bets, you're not going to be able to see it immediately in a spreadsheet, unfortunately. But as I've seen our continual lift, and especially for profitable growth, it really matters. And I think we all know it's just so much more capital efficient when you have inbound people coming to want to buy from you. Even if you have a sales team like we do, having the person coming and wanting to buy is just so much easier than going out there and having to hunt for every single deal. And then finally, in 2022, we'd always been approached by a lot of investors. I'm sure all your inboxes are, if you're at a couple million in ARR even, are getting filled by investors, and I always told them to go away. But finally, we had one that I'd gotten to know for a while, Susquehanna Growth Equity, approach us. A few others did too. So we finally said, okay, let's talk to people. We wanted to get to a scale where we could do a round that'd be really meaningful and still stay in control. So my co-founder and I are still the majority owner, is still in control of the company. Very, very little has changed culturally. But by partnering with a growth investor, we were able to really kind of just give ourselves a lot more firepower should we ever want to do an acquisition, just have kind of more optionality. And it was also kind of our signal to the market, we're here to go long, to go big. And one secret I learned is that I was like, well, what do we call this round? And I looked it up. You know, Series A just means it's your first series. So I'm like, well, it's our first institutional capital, so it's a Series A. And we'll see if we ever do a Series B. But that's how we branded it in the press. So never too late to do your Series A. And so finally, I want to talk about how we're thinking about scaling for the future, and hope some of this ends up being useful to all of you too. First, I want to tell you about talent. We always place a really big focus on this. Just in the past year or so, we added a new CRO, a new CMO, a new AI lead. I'm proud to say, too, we have a lot of our old timers at the company still with us, working with these new executives, you know, both learning from them with the function, and the new executives learning with our longtime team members about our market and the particulars of our customers. But this is one thing that I think, if you're bootstrapping, it's important to think about. I found before we raised the growth round, when I was recruiting more serious executives to join us, it was a little more work, because there is this unfortunate perception of bootstrappers that, hey, we're just lifestyle businesses. We're spending most of our time surfing or playing golf. And then executives wonder, hey, if I join this company, like, are they serious? Will this look good on my resume? Will there be equity compensation that will ever be worth something? We always did all that just as rigorously as any other company, especially any venture-backed or PE-backed company. But I had to do a lot more work in the recruitment process to really convince these executives that we were serious, that we were operating professionally, that their equity comp would one day be worth something. I found once we did do the growth round, I just didn't get any of those questions anymore. People just assumed, okay, it's a good company to join, it'll be good for my career, the equity comp will be worth something. So I think that is a benefit to raising money, the talent you can access. But I'm also here to tell you that you can still get great talent without raising money. You just have to work a bit harder to do it and really go out of your way to show that you're operating as professionally as someone who's raised outside money. I also want to talk about how we evolved our workplace. When we started, we had an office in New York, and by the time pre-pandemic in 2022, we had a beautiful office in Soho, rooftop access. This was like the young Greg dream of like what success is like for a startup. Still, though, only half the team was in New York. We were very remote friendly. We never forced the people in New York to actually come to the office. Most days, like less than half the team, even in New York, would come to the office, unless we had free food, in which case just about everybody came. So when the pandemic hit, it was very easy for us just to tell everyone, hey, we already have Zoom, we already have Slack, just don't come in tomorrow. We grew a lot during the pandemic. So by the time our lease was up a year later, only a third of the company was in New York, since the new people we brought in were disproportionately out of New York. And we surveyed the New Yorkers if they'd want to come back after the, you know, once it was safe to. And everybody was like, maybe I'd come in once or twice a week to see my friends, but I don't know if I actually would. So we ditched the office, went fully remote, and since then we've, you know, pretty much quadrupled in size. So it's really, really worked for us. And again, you know, now when we do a talent search, it seems kind of insane to me to limit the search to one or two geographies, even if it's a great geography, like here in Austin or San Francisco or New York, because there's so much great talent out there. You can get anywhere. Our CROs in the Bay Area, our CMOs in Boston, our CFOs in New Hampshire. We just got a great team, but they're not in one place. And instead, we do quarterly exec offsites. We pick a new city every time. And then we do an annual all-company offsite, which we just did last December. We brought over 250 people to Cancun, Mexico, and had a great time. And no one came up to me and said, hey, I would rather go to an office 5 days a week than come here for this offsite. So it's been a great mode to switch to. And of course, here's our obligatory AI slide, but it's something where I found on the SaaS journey, being on it now since 2011, there's just always something new and you always got to quickly adapt to it. So just a couple weeks after ChatGPT came out, we launched PressPal AI, a press release generative AI agent that also suggests journalists to pitch to. And then over time, as a lot of concerns have grown around AI, we've really gotten that ahead of presenting AI standards for the whole public relations industry out there. So that's pretty much our journey here, just going from bootstrapping in the early days to scaling up to 50 million plus in ARR and still scaling past that to raising funding. I'm happy to take any questions. As I mentioned, I'm just at Gregory on Instagram and Twitter, or Instagram and X now. You can look me up on LinkedIn, find me around today. I've got 10 more seconds. I kind of want to wait for the opera music to come out so I can thank everybody, including my agent, and get dragged off stage. But I know they're running a little behind, so I'll get, oh, there it is. All right, great. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for listening. Have a great day. Have a good one.